accession number 9434, reel 7.
Mr. Bill Collins, reel 7. I wonder if you could tell me what brigade and division the number 1 Cavalry Field Ambulance was attached to?
Well, we were the field ambulance for number 1 Cavalry Brigade, the 1st Cavalry Brigade, the 1st Cavalry Division.
Do you remember, sir, which units were you in touch with?
Well, the regiments in the brigade were the 2nd Dragoon Guards, the Queen's Bays, the 5th Dragoon Guards, and the 11th Hussars.
So they were the...
three regiments in the brigade.
You were in touch with.
Yes, they were the people whose casualties we dealt with, you see.
Could you tell me a little about the organisation of the number 1 Cavalry Field Ambulance, the personnel and how you were... where you fitted into that organisation?
Yes, well, we had six very light field ambulances which could go across almost any country. Each field ambulance was drawn by 2 horses... of a medium type, which could go at a pace if required, a good fast trot if required. And we had a sergeant of the Army Service Corps, as it was then, and, of course, the drivers were all members of the Army Service Corps. We had a saddler attached to us to deal with harness problems. And... as regards the personnel of the field ambulance itself, there was a commanding officer, 3 other officers, there were 6 sergeants, 2 corporals, and the rest were privates. You see, the total establishment, I should say, was about between 60 and 70. You see, the men, the privates, were each assigned to one of the 6 ambulances, so that in action, each ambulance had its quota of men to act as stretcher bearers.
What was carried in each ambulance? Was it the same as in the Maltese cart that we discussed earlier?
No. The ambulances could carry 4 stretcher cases, or 6 sitting wounded.
But what medical supplies and equipment were contained in?
Not in the ambulances, no. There were no medical supplies in the ambulances. They were carried, for instance, I carried what was known as a surgical haversack. And in the haversack which I carried, like a pack on my back, were bandages, iodine, scissors, quarter grain morphia tablets, everything one needed, gauze, wool, everything one needed to dress a wound properly.
Now, I noticed you said you had the morphine with you this time, whereas last time, in the previous unit, that could only be issued on by application to the officer. Was that a change?
Yes. The quarter grain tablets, of course, were normally never administered except by the instructions of a medical officer.
But you were allowed to carry them?
Not at any time.
Now, what was your reception on arrival to this unit?
Oh, reception was quite good. I was very young, of course. I was 20. And they immediately called me Sonny.
That was your nickname?
My nickname.
Was there a specific ambulance you were attached to, or what responsibilities were you given within the unit?
Yes, well, no, I had one ambulance... But very soon, I was given the job of looking after the forward 2 ambulances, a forward unit, which went into a close action with the brigade. We organised the advanced aid post. That is the aid post closest to the firing line. You see. Getting the casualties with the 2 ambulances, taking them to this advanced aid post point, and from where, of course, they were transferred by motor car or other ambulances farther back. You see.
Now, you say you got the casualties in your ambulance and then took them to this advanced aid post. Who would have brought that? You wouldn't go right forward with the ambulances, would you? Who brought them to where you could pick them up in the ambulances?
Oh, no, we went right forward. I took ambulances right up to the edge of Sanctuary Wood. That's within, I mean, within not very far from the front line itself. After dusk at night, I regularly went up to Sanctuary Wood, with the two ambulances.
So, would you actually go forward with your stretcher bearers from there to the front line to bring people back, or would the regimental Red Cross bring them back?
Actually, when we got to Sanctuary Wood, the casualties were there waiting for us. They had been brought to the medical officer's post, you see, which was quite close to the line, and we took them from there.
What exactly was the first aid post? What did that consist of?
Well, the first aid post consisted of any place, a cellar, anywhere with a bit of shelter or a head cover, where a stretcher could be laid on a crate or a box or a ledge, or anywhere where a stretcher could be laid, so that the medical officer could give a thorough inspection to the wounds.
So this was where the medical officer was based.
Yes, but there was another medical officer always, of course, with the regiment itself. Every battalion, every regiment had its own medical officer right in the line.
So could you take me through the typical stages of treatment of a wound at this time, say in the Sanctuary Wood area, as the wounded man would see it? If you got, say, a medium wound, what would happen to him? Well, where would he be treated?
He would be treated by the battalion medical officer. Or you see, in Sanctuary Wood, the three cavalry regiments of the 1st Brigade each contributed practically a company to form what was known as a composite battalion, you see. There were Hussars and Dragoon Guards, and they formed a composite battalion. The medical officer there, he treated the wounds there on the spot. I had nothing to do in the way of dressing wounds unless they happened on the way up or on the way down.
So when someone was wounded in the front line, they'd be immediately treated by the... What sort of treatment would he be able to do in the front line? What would that consist of, usually?
Oh, it consists of bandaging, a tourniquet if necessary. The medical officer, he had his haversack, he had supplies to deal with wounds.
But it would only be...
It would only be of a nature to keep the wound from getting worse until he got down to... down to the advanced aid post.
So, you did nothing to them, you just carried them?
We just carried them, yes. We just carried them.
Now, when you got to the first aid post, what extra treatment or what continued treatment would they get there?
Well, you see, when we got there, they were taken down into this cellar and laid up or stood up for the attention of... Captain Rogers, it was, who we had there, the Royal Army Medical Corps, if they were stretcher cases. But if they were walking cases, he came up and treated them out in the open, you see.
Now, what would this treatment be of any more sophisticated nature than they'd already had? Or would it just be a repatching, rebandaging...
A repatching and rebanding, and it wouldn't be a sophisticated treatment, because the job was to get these casualties away from the line, the danger line, you see. And this was the place where we were, the old convent on the Menin Road, close to a place called Hellfire Corner, was under. Always being shelled all the time, you see. So the object was to give them a temporary treatment and get them away out of it through the other side to the casualty clearing station.
What would happen in the cases of a very bad wound that needed urgent, more serious medical attention? Would they be able to try and do anything about that, or would it just be rushed back as soon as possible?
Be rushed back as soon as possible.
So there's nothing that could be done?
Nothing could be done, no, up there.
So, when would they get their first serious medical attention? That would be after it had gone out of your unit's hands, would it?
Well, after it had gone out of our unit, when they got to the casualty clearing station. It's, and then there was operating theatres and everything to carry out the treatment.
Who ran the casualty clearing station?
The Royal Army Medical Corps.
But it wasn't part of your unit.
No, they were not a frontline unit. You see, they were usually about 20 miles or so behind the line.
Right. Now, you joined the number 1 Cavalry Field Ambulance. Where exactly were they when they joined? You said they went up to the... you're obviously in the Ypres sector by Sanctuary Wood. And is that where they were when you joined them?
No, I joined them at the place near a small mountain known as the Mont de Car, the Cat's Mount, MONTDESCATS. There was a monastery there, a Trappist monastery, and where, you know, the inmates never speak. It's a silent order. And it was close to that place that we were billeted. But we weren't there very long, because on the 22nd of April, the Germans attacked with gas.
Right, could you run me through this story then?
Yes. Pardon?
Could you tell me about this?
Yes, well, as soon as the first gas attack took place, we were on our way quickly up to Ypres. We were at a place called Vlamertang, close to the canal bank, you see. And we stood by, but we didn't go into either, but never got into action there. But 10 days later, on the...
What did you hear? This was the first gas attack on the Western Front. What did you hear about gas? What did you think about it when you heard the first rumours?
Well, we only got the small whiffs of it back there. We didn't think much about it because we weren't allowed to move, you see. We were kept there. We just arrived at this near Vlamertang, and we stopped there and never moved until we moved back slightly again.
During this week, were you given any instructions on how to treat gas patients or how to avoid the effects of gas?
No, no.
So they didn't respond very quickly?
No, because the gas attacks were sprung on the British army, mainly the Canadians. They were sprung on out of the blue. There was no warning whatever that the gas was going to come.
Right, so you pulled back from Vlamertang.
So we then pulled back. But in a few days' time, we went back in again to Ypres, across the square, up through the Menin Gate, and we stopped at... I'm now talking about my advanced unit, not the field ambulance. The field ambulance stayed behind the other side of Ypres. But I was in charge of the advanced unit, which consisted of 2 light ambulances and 8 men I had, 8 men, and we moved up. And quartered ourselves in in the courtyard, or what remained of it, of a large building, the convent. It was a Roman Catholic convent, but most of it was lying on the ground. It had been shelled down almost down to... It was shelled down to 6 feet high level, you see. But in the cellars, which were very capacious, we occupied one, the nearest one to the drive, which there was a slight drive off the road up to these ruins. We occupied one cellar, and away to our right, the brigade staff, at least the battalion, it was their battalion staff, you know, but it was a brigade staff because each regiment had contributed, they occupied the rest.
This was the near Hellfire Corner.
It was, yeah, this was about 100 yards below Hellfire, what was afterwards known as Hellfire Corner. You see, the junction consisted of the road out from the Menin Gate, the road up to Hooge, which is straight ahead, to the east. The right hand road went up to Zillebeck and Sanctuary Wood, and the left hand road went to Potige, Saint-Jean and Saint-Julien.
Now, where was where were your cavalry? They were in Sanctuary Wood, weren't they?
They were in the composite battalion of the cavalry regiments was in the northern end of Sanctuary Wood.
Now, could you take me through what happened over the next few days then?
Yes, well, every evening I used to take up an ambulance to... the edge of the wood to collect casualties. There were always casualties of some sort. And at dusk, we used to go up at dusk because you couldn't move in daylight there. Anything that moved in daylight would be shelled or machine gunned out of existence. And even then, after dusk, the bullets were hitting the low hedge that marked the track up to the wood. They were smacking into it all the way up. And we went up there. And
what was the state of the ground like from the shelling? Was it difficult to drive the ambulance?
No. It was not difficult at all, because the shelling wasn't of a sort. They were mostly high bursts. They weren't designed to blow in trenches, you see.
So it was shrapnel, mainly.
It was somewhat explosive, but it was shrapnel and higher bursts.
So you were going forward to Sanctuary Wood each night.
Yeah, every night I went up for several nights, and when I got there, I went to the hut, which was occupied by Captain Wagstaff, Royal Army Medical Corps, and as I learned afterwards, by the officer commanding the composite battalion, Lieutenant Colonel Pittman, T.T. Pittman, and who afterwards became a Major General later in the war. He commanded the 3rd Cavalry Division later in the war, and as I'll tell you later on, was probably the man as responsible as anyone for stopping the German advance in front of Amiens in March 1918.
We'll have to talk about that, yeah. So, were you having a lot of casualties on these visits when you picked up people from Sanctuary Wood?
No, I was getting about half a dozen a night. No more.
What sort of wounds were they mainly?
Well, they were mainly bullet wounds and small shell wounds. Nothing very serious. Sometimes they couldn't work. I had one or two cases where we had to stretcher them, but they weren't. I never had a serious one. Had some very peculiar ones.
What were they?
Well, I had one. Lieutenant Renton, AFG Renton of the 11th Hussars, a bullet hit him in the chest, hit one of the buttons on his tunic, went along his chest and made a wound, and then flew straight up in the air, he told me afterwards. But there it was, a wound and hadn't been treated.
Had by this time, was there any concept of a blighty wound by this time? Were people quite glad to be wounded and out of it?
Oh, yes, they were blighty wounded all right. Because when that composite battalion was relieved and came out, we had a couple of them hit by the sporadic fire that was always going on there, and I heard the chaps who weren't hit said lucky blighter, he's got a blighty wound. They already had the word blighty was in use as an expression of luck, of good luck. You see?
So that was already by the first, just by April 15th?
Yes, by April 15th, yeah.
What about yourself? Would you have welcomed a small wound?
No, I don't think so. I never even thought about it, you know. I had a fatalistic approach to it. If you're going to get... every soldier out there by that time... Had adopted the fatalistic expression, if you're going to get it, if your number's on it, you'll get it, and if it isn't, you won't.
Now, this period while you were going up to Sanctuary Wood and you were in the advanced position at the convent was from the 28th of April to the 4th of May. Now, I believe there was another gas attack on the 3rd of May. I wonder if you could take me through what happened on that evening.
Yes, on the night before this gas attack, I'd gone up to the line as usual and cleared what... we had a few casualties, take down, and we finished at about 4 o'clock in the morning. And I told my driver, I had one ambulance ready in case all was... I told my standby driver, George Kislingberry, he was a Berkshire ploughboy of the Army Service Corps, and as a brave as a lion, one of the best, I told him not to be in a hurry, because I had a premonition we might be wanted again, but I wasn't prepared for what happened. About 10 minutes later, a message came out from the brigade office You're going to go up to Sanctuary Wood at once to pick up a casualty. Well, of course, it was getting close to dawn, and I had forebodings about going up there in daylight, because I had an idea that we'd be lucky to ever to get back if we'd attempted it, you see. The fellows who worked on the telephone lines from brigade headquarters there in the convent up to Sanctuary Wood were becoming casualties. And one fellow was killed 2 days before, mending the line in broad daylight. They put a machine gun right into him, you see. So it was very difficult to move in daylight there. It was an open hillside. There's nothing to stop from a place called Observatory Ridge, right over by Hill 60, up to Sanctuary Woods. There was a clear space with no trees, just slopes and grass. And Sanctuary Wood, being on an eminence, Sanctuary Wood was on ahead of at the top of a small rise out of the road from Zillebeck. And I had some forebodings about this business in daylight. But anyway, I said to George Kislingberry, "Come on, George, let's get up there and get it over as quickly as possible, and take a, see what we can do." And he got turned around. We got on the ambulance, trotted up to Zillebeck, up the crossroads, up to Zillebeck Road, straight up the track to Sanctuary Wood, and I hurried into the wood to the huts. Captain Wagstaff's hut, and he had a casualty there. Looked a bit queer in the face to me, but he had no bodily wounds, you see. And I said to Captain Wagstaff, "I don't hope you don't mind, sir, if I hurry back, because it's breaking day, and it's not going to be a very good trip back." And he looked at me as if, you know, as if I'd suddenly got the wind up or something. But I always smelt trouble there. And so anyway, we got this chap on board the ambulance, got down to about 150 yards or so before the road turns off to Zillebeck and the lake. And behind me, on the track, were enormous explosions, bang, bang, one after the other. And I turned back, my head back, when I was sitting on the box with the ambulance with Kislingberry, and I turned back and looked, and there, where we just passed were shell explosions right down the track. Now, they followed us down at about 40 yards distance, right down the road, right past the junction, the road up to Zillebeck and the lake, right down the road to where it joins the Menin Road. And alongside between the Zillebeck Road and the Menin Road, there was a company digging in a trench on the Ypres side of the road. Obviously, there was going to be trouble, because that bombardment heralded an attack. That bombardment would never take place unless an attack was going to follow, you see. What they were trying to do was to stop any reinforcements getting up to Sanctuary Wood. So anyway, we got on down there. We went as we passed the... it was now daylight. It was now broad daylight. And as we passed this company digging in there, they all stopped work, stood up in their trenches and cheered us to the echo. I never felt, you know, quite so big in all my life as that company, standing up and cheering us, because they could see behind us the trail of bursting shells, which we were just keeping ahead of all the way down. Anyway, we got down and got into the convent again. I took down this casualty and looked at him. He looked very funny about the face. There must have been something badly wrong with him. But he was very soon dispatched, because the motor ambulances, the first motor ambulance used to call up about 8 o'clock from the other side of Ypres, from the main body of the ambulance, field ambulance. And we got him away quickly, but I could never really fathom whether that fellow was an agent, or what he was. He didn't look like an ordinary soldier, but anyway, there he was, and his tag was marked dysentery. But of course, that in itself may have been a good reason, because there's nothing worse than dysentery in a body of soldiers. It can go through them like wildfire. So it may be that he was, after all, a dysentery patient. But anyway, we risked our lives going up there at that time and coming down in the daylight for a man who hadn't got a bodily wound but had got a complaint, you see. Anyway, we got back to the convent, and all day, all that day, we were working, doing casualties. I was binding casualties. The medical officer was treating them, the worst ones, and they were streaming at us from down the Menin Road from Hooge, and up from down from Sanctuary Wood, or everywhere, because the Germans attacked quite in force with gas at Hooge. The gas came over at Hooge, and between Hooge and Sanctuary Wood, the gas cloud came over. And you see, Sanctuary Wood, being on a bit of an eminence, missed the gas cloud up there, but below where the lake was, the water attracted it. And the Menin Road being on the low side, it came down there. It dripped. The wind was absolutely favourable to the German gas attack, and it drifted down there, and it stayed down there until 8 o'clock that night. And hardly ever, when it got to the Telfire Corner and to our place at the convent, it stayed there and it stuck there and it never shifted. There was no breeze. It wouldn't have blown a match out. There was no wind of any kind, not later in the evening, and it came down and just stayed there. And of course, when we went up again in the evening, we had these so-called masks which were supplied. I must tell you that during the day, we had some all sorts of casualties, but I noticed there was one event there which sticks in my mind. I heard a noise of motor cars on the Menin Road just below our aid post, and I went down to look at them, and there were two Rolls-Royce motor cars with conning towers. And in them were Vickers guns, Vickers machine guns, and there were two of them, and there was an officer walking around with a spade beard, a pointed beard, and I looked at him and I recognised him as a Wing Commander Samson of the Royal Naval Air Service, one of these, devil may care, do or die fellows that did all sorts of jobs. And there he was, commanding this Rolls-Royce machine gun squadron, standing there outside our convent ruins. He stood on the road and stayed there, waiting, looking up at the Menin Road all the time, because what they were afraid of was that the gas would succeed and the Germans would advance straight down the Menin Road into the Menin Gate with the aid of the gas, you see. But there were some very stout fellows in the trenches at the Menin Gate at Hooge, and they stopped them.